As Ukraine marks 3 months of war, its government accuses Russia as grain goes missing.
According to the Ministry of Agrarian Policy of Ukraine, Russian forces have already stolen more than 400,000 tons of grain.
Plus, as U.S. President Joe Biden wraps up his Asia trip, what challenges face the U.S. and the Quad to address concerns of countries in the region who've abstained from condemning Russia's aggression?
A lot of these countries in South Asia, Africa, Southeast Asia sort of have this history of being a part of the non-aligned movement.
And later in the program, how the pandemic and war have created new billionaires. Today is Tuesday, May 24th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. As Ukraine marks 3 months since the start of the Russian invasion, residents in the capital of Kyiv are commemorating those who have been lost since the start of the conflict. Small Ukrainian flags have been placed on a lawn in a square in Kyiv as a tribute to those who have lost their lives since the war broke out on February 24th. A monument displays the message, "Ukrainians killed by Putin," with the number 7,463 written below it. The United Nations, however, have only recorded 3,930 civilian casualties during the conflict. Russia has repeatedly denied targeting civilian areas and accused Ukraine, without evidence, of using people as human shields. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, who was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, said that Russian President Vladimir Putin had not only failed to stop NATO's expansion, as was his wish late last year, but he has also not achieved his strategic goals in Ukraine.
The plan was to take Kyiv, to decapitate the government, and to control the country. He has been forced to withdraw his forces from Kyiv and the north of the country. Russian forces have been pushed out of the Kharkiv region, and the offensive in Donbas is moving very slowly. I'm not predicting the outcome of this war. No one can do that. But I'm only saying the obvious thing, that Russia did not achieve its goals in Ukraine. This plan was a short military operation. It's a long, costly war for Russia.
Stoltenberg added that he was confident that discussions with Turkey over its opposition to both Finland and Sweden's applications for membership in the NATO military alliance would be successful. The Finnish foreign minister also added on Tuesday that Finland and Sweden will send delegations to Ankara on Wednesday to try and resolve Turkish opposition to their applications for membership. In Ukraine, Reuters' Louisa Knox brings us this story, where after 3 months of war, the subway systems in Kharkiv are expected to reopen.
Thousands of residents in Ukraine's second-largest city had sought shelter on the underground network during months of relentless bombardment, sleeping on station platforms or inside train carriages. Among them, Natalia Lopanska. She says she has been living in a train carriage with her son since March the 3rd. But now the city's mayor has asked residents sheltering in carriages to return home or to move onto the station platforms so the trains can start running once again. The metro's reopening is a symbol of Ukraine's biggest military success over the past few weeks, pushing Russian forces largely out of artillery range of Kharkiv, as they did from the capital Kyiv in March.
Louisa Knox of Reuters News. Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba on Tuesday said via Twitter that Russia is stealing Ukrainian grain and urged the world not to buy what has been stolen. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv about the Ukrainian government's claims.
We should start back from the occupation of Kherson region and the partly the Zaporizhia region, because I think that like 2 weeks from in the occupation, these areas are starting to suffer from Russia in terms of grains. So these two regions have the most grains storages in Ukraine. And basically, they produce most of the grain, of the Ukrainian grain. And for quite a long time now, Ukrainian government is putting this problem to the public stage because this is a huge problem. According to the Ministry of Agrarian Policy of Ukraine, Russian forces have already stolen more than 400,000 tons of grain. And this is information as of period of now. So we don't know exactly, of course, the full amount, but this is something that have been already confirmed. And storages has at least 1.3 million tons of grains. Also today, we had new images from Maxar Technologies seeing another two ships storing and carrying away a lot of grains. We don't know exactly the amount, and we of course cannot verify, but it looks so it happens again. So it's not the first time that we see this image. And reportedly, one of the ship is going to Syria, and another one is taking direction to Beirut.
Anna, there's also some stark reporting coming out of Mariupol, which, of course, is now under Russian control. What can you tell us about what the government is saying, about what they've uncovered there?
Well, Mariupol remains, even after Ukrainian forces have left Azovstal plant, it still remains one of the biggest problems, because due to the occupation, Ukrainian officials cannot get all the information about Russian crimes and the whole picture of the humanitarian situation, which is there. But what we definitely know is that every day more and more victims are found under the rubble of buildings of around the city, because there are just huge amount of damages in these areas. And today, according to the advisor to the mayor of Mariupol, we received information that about 200 victims were found under the rubble of a high-rise building. This is one of the buildings that was destroyed quite in the beginning of the invasion. And what we also know that due to the refusal of locals to collect and pack the bodies, because this is exactly what Russian forces are doing, they involve locals to do this kind of job. They refused, and basically Russian army just left the place of this works. And what we also can see that the bodies of the dead remained in place, and the smell, the particular smell, is also in there around the neighborhood, because these bodies seem to be lying there for quite a long time.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Ending his six-day trip to Asia, U.S. President Joe Biden used the war in Ukraine to send a message to China to uphold the fundamental principles of the international order. In a joint statement, the Quad leaders, quote, reiterated our strong resolve to maintain the peace and stability in the region. We underscored unequivocally that the centerpiece of the international order is international law, including the UN Charter, respect for sovereignty, and territorial integrity for all states, end quote. Now, to discuss the impact and the role of the Quad, a group that was originally formed to address China's influence, I caught up with Jeff Smith, a research fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center.
Yeah, so it in some ways mirrors what's been happening at a bilateral level between India and the U.S., which is statements of condemnation of Russia's actions in Ukraine, strong statements by the U.S., and then sort of more vague and generalized statements from the Indian side, in effect condemning Russia's actions in Ukraine without specifically naming Russia. So condemning the use of force and any attempt to change borders. And, you know, India's position has effectively been, we want this war to end, but we're not going to go out on a limb and criticize Russia directly. And that phenomenon has been playing out at the bilateral level, and I think we saw that to a degree also at the Quad level and in the Quad joint statement. And, you know, Prime Minister Modi, I think in his own remarks, carefully avoided condemning Russia, But they have, in the sort of subtle language of diplomacy, been moving toward stronger condemnations of Russia's actions in Ukraine. And that's what happened at the Quad.
So, I mean, I guess I want to expand upon that, because if we take a look at, you know, the members of the Quad, Australia, India, Japan, and of course the United States, there are other countries in South Asia and Southeast Asia that are not part of it. And there's, of course, the ASEAN countries that have their own association. So do you see the Quad being an extra vessel, kind of what you mentioned just before, to expand upon bilateral negotiations and discussions?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, you know, the Quad rests atop this network of very strong bilateral and trilateral connections that had already existed. I mean, obviously, the United States has formal treaty alliances with Australia and Japan. Those two also do a lot of strong cooperation with each other. You know, that's existed for decades. And the U.S.-India relationship has grown tremendously over the past 20 years. And so the Quad is in some ways like the top layer of icing on this cake, on this network of existing relationships. And I think it's helpful in showing that, you know, on a lot of issues, and particularly those issues in the Indo-Pacific, these four democracies are aligned. They have, you know, similar visions for a free and open Indo-Pacific and what type of rules should undergird that order. They have similar threat assessments on who is acting belligerently and who is undermining the international order. They also, I think, are four countries with, you know, the will and capability to push back against China when it's acting belligerently. But they are four Indo-Pacific democracies that are focused on cooperation in the Indo-Pacific. And I think that's where their alignment is the strongest. And that's where the focus has been and likely where the focus will remain. And so, you know, it's not surprising to me that on issues outside the Indo-Pacific, there's not always perfect alignment, like on issues like Ukraine, I mean, on Russia. That's maybe natural and should be expected. But in the Indo-Pacific, I think the Quad's foundations are quite strong. And I think it's supplementing existing organizations and initiatives like ASEAN, rather than competing with them.
Jeff, I wanted to ask you this. If we take a look at the United Nations, there were several Southeastern Asian countries as well as countries from Africa that abstained from votes that would directly condemn Russia. Do you see the Quad as an extra opportunity for diplomatic efforts to not only address the concerns that these countries have, but also a way to help bring them into the fold of an international coalition to oppose Russian aggression?
Yeah, I think there are several factors at play. You know, a lot of these countries in South Asia, Africa, Southeast Asia sort of have this history of being a part of the non-aligned movement. And so it's actually sort of consistent with their international voting records to abstain from votes like this. There's still, you know, frankly, some historical resentment toward the U.S. and the West over colonialism, over historical grievances. And so the U.S. sometimes faces resistance in building support among third world countries and in Africa on questions like this. You know, there's also sort of pragmatic, sort of realist thinking taking hold. And I think a lot of these countries, and I would include India in the mix, you know, do fear some sort of retribution from Russia if they take too critical of a stand. And, you know, a country like India is in a unique position, but there are many others who, frankly, have a lot of their military hardware and military equipment is of Russian stock. You know, Russia is one of the world's leading arms suppliers, particularly at discounted prices. You know, to poor developing countries have historically tended to buy Russian hardware. And so many of them actually fear that President Putin, that Russia would seek to punish them in some way if they openly speak out against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And if, you know, 80% of your military stock is Russian hardware, Moscow actually does have some levers to inflict pain and cause discomfort. And so I think, you know, there are both philosophical and practical reasons why there's been resistance among some parts of the world to more forcefully condemning Russia. There are things that the U.S. can do to help address some of these concerns, but in many cases, this is a long-term evolution. You know, we've been trying to wean India off of Russian hardware for 10 years. There's some progress being made, but to be honest, it would likely take another 10 to 20 years. Even if India were to stop purchasing Russian hardware today, the majority of its existing equipment would still be Russian origin, would still require Russian servicing and spare parts. And so I think there's a realization inside the U.S. government that this is really a generational issue rather than one that will produce quick results.
Jeff Smith is a research fellow at the Asian Studies Centers with the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Jeff, thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely.
As worries mount about food shortages due to the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict, Egypt, the world's largest importer of wheat, says it's preparing a series of agricultural projects to help curb food imports and provide increasingly for the domestic market in a sustainable fashion. The projects, which are part of the Egyptian government's efforts to improve agricultural output by 2030, have been in development for several years. Edward Uranian has that story.
Egyptian leaders recently announced the country is in the process of developing a series of agricultural projects that will increase domestic output and decrease reliance on imports of foreign agricultural products. At the inauguration of one of the new projects, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said water usage is a major issue in increasing production, but he said the government has found solutions to the problem. The president said Egypt is getting the water from several main sources. Some water is coming from wells, while some is coming from agricultural treatment plants that will purify the water according to WHO standards. None of the water for this project is coming from the Nile River, he adds. The project director, Bahal Ghanem, says that it will be carried out in four phases, noting that a special focus is being put on wheat production, given projected international wheat shortages due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. He says that Egypt imported $8 billion worth of wheat, corn and soybeans in 2021, but that the agricultural projects being built will help reduce imports and alleviate any crisis resulting from the Russia-Ukraine conflict or COVID-19. Wheat cultivation, he adds, is due to increase from 40,000 acres this year to 120,000 in 2023. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA Egypt will overcome wheat shortages by producing more wheat and diversifying its imports, but that there could be potential problems in 2023 if the Ukraine conflict continues and climate change affects wheat-producing countries. Sadiq points out that some North African countries like Algeria buy their wheat from Russia and are less likely to have a shortage. Morocco, on the other hand, he says, is having climate problems which could affect production. Ahmed Abu Yazid, a professor at Ain Shams University's Agricultural College, told Egyptian TV the government is implementing a strategy of developing all the infrastructure for the new agricultural projects, including water and electricity. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that the new Daba agricultural project, located between Giza and Alexandria, will increase cultivation of wheat, potatoes, sugar beets, and sunflower oil, along with other vegetables. Paul Sullivan, a Middle East analyst at the Atlantic Council, says countries like Egypt could conceivably increase production.
There's always hope for increasing agricultural output, but it would be best to have land and water efficient crops But hybrid varieties that can prosper in hotter, drier weather would also help.
Sullivan argues that the Egyptian government will do what it can to alleviate any shortages, but that may not keep food inflation at bay given the world's wheat situation. He blames Russia for preventing wheat from leaving Ukraine and the Black Sea as the main culprit for wheat prices and shortages in the world. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Food and energy sector billionaires have grown their wealth by nearly $500 billion over the past 2 years, thanks to soaring energy and commodity prices both during the pandemic and the war in Ukraine. That's according to a new analysis from Oxfam. I spoke with VOA's Henry Ridgewell in London to learn more about the so-called new class of food billionaires.
Yes, Oxfam makes the point that over the past 2 years, most people around the world have suffered through the pandemic, either because their jobs have disappeared or because they have faced greater expenses. Generally, it's been a tough time for everyone. But what they're saying is for these select band of billionaires around the world, a select band but a growing band, it's actually been a hugely prosperous time. They say that of the world's, what they calculate as over 2,500 billionaires now around the world, their wealth has risen by some $3.78 trillion since 2020 when the pandemic first broke out. They say that there are 573 new billionaires since that time in 2020. And of them, the world's 10 richest men now own more wealth than the poorest 40% of humanity. That's some 3.1 billion people. You can look at these statistics. They are all really striking and shocking in many ways, given the state of inequality, given the state of the economies of many countries. And Oxfam says that it's time that governments around the world tackled this inequality now.
Did they have any recommendations? Because this report is coming out when the World Economic Forum is meeting in Davos, Switzerland, and food security and renewable energy are major items on that meeting's agenda.
They do. And the central premise of what they want is fairer and greater taxation on these super wealthy billionaires. The point they make, that Oxfam makes and others, is that the wealth of these individuals has increased so significantly, largely because of government interventions through the course of the pandemic. You'll recall the billions of dollars that was plowed into research for pharmaceuticals to get those vaccines, but also the billions or trillions of dollars that were plowed into economies in terms of furlough schemes, in terms of propping up businesses and economies to get them through the lockdowns. That had the effect of inflating asset prices, the shares and the companies that many of these billionaires own, and therefore they have got a lot richer over the past 2 years. Now, add on to that the rising food and energy prices and the concurrent profits that these companies have made in more recent months, and that's the cocktail that has produced this huge wealth. Oxfam says it is our money, it is taxpayers' money that has helped to get these billionaires so rich, and therefore we should start clawing it back in various methods of taxation, be that wealth taxes, be that windfall taxes on the large profits being made, for example, by some food and energy companies. That's what they want. Some governments are supportive of that. Portugal, Italy, among the countries that have imposed windfall taxes. Other governments, for example, in Britain and elsewhere, say that such taxes would deter investment by these energy companies at a time when the world is trying to diversify away from Russian energy imports.
Henry Ridgewell reporting for us from London. Henry, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, good. Thanks, Steve.
On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.